KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We are looking at this evidence, and we have to determine whether it's cause or effect.
If you want to sort of acknowledge him but not threaten him, you sing back one of the other songs that you share with him, but not the one that he sang.
Almost instantly, you are going on this journey with Albert and with Joey, and you're seeing the horrors depicted and the struggles and the love and the wonderful things that happen right in this story through the eye of this animal.
An animal which is a puppet on stage at Warhorse, a big puppet, doesn't really do it justice. We're going to talk with three actors who manipulate that creature on stage for Warhorse. It's coming up this hour on Weekday. Also, we're going to travel out to the field to start some fights with song sparrows. But we start with Boeing. The National Transportation Safety Board Chair Deborah Hersman was speaking about the 787 batteries earlier this month. Boeing officials meet with the FAA today in Washington, D.C. to present a plan they hope will have the Dreamliner flying again in weeks. Attention has focused on cells within the lithium-ion battery that powers the 787. The company's fleet of Dreamliners has been grounded since a battery fire aboard a Japan Airlines 787 last month. This week, United Airlines announced they would keep most of their 787s on the ground through at least early June. John Ostrower covers Boeing and aerospace for the Wall Street Journal. John, thanks for joining us to talk to us again.
Thanks for having me.
So Boeing officials are meeting with FAA officials today about this battery fix. We've heard a little bit about the fix, a stronger case around the battery, also some tubing to vent any potential fumes. Is that what the FAA is looking for, do you know?
Well, right now, what Boeing and the FAA are doing, they should be meeting in D.C. right about now, is looking at a series of modifications to both the aircraft and the battery system that really center around first on one fold, is really kind of containing the battery should it fail. And on the second half of that is redesigning the battery to make sure if a failure does happen in an individual cell, it's contained and doesn't spread throughout the battery.
You know, Boeing hasn't ever talked about abandoning the lithium-ion battery for the nickel-cadmium battery, has it?
Well, they really haven't, and that goes back to some design decisions that they made years ago about the electrical system. And the 787's electrical system is what's known as a more electric architecture, which is to say that it uses electricity rather than high-pressure, high-temperature air taken off the engines for powering various systems on the aircraft. So, for example, because of that higher electrical requirement, Boeing provided the 787 with a set of lithium-ion batteries. Those batteries are primarily used to wake up the aircraft when it's kind of awoken from a cold and dark state, as it's known, and give the pilots the ability to see the displays and turn on the various systems and get things powered up. The second battery helps spool up the auxiliary power unit, which provides power while on the ground or in the air during an emergency if it's needed. So these significant tasks really require both a higher level of power quality compared to a nickel-cadmium battery that you can really only get with a lithium-ion, because it's just a much cleaner power, as it's been described to me by folks, that essentially, and when you anchor the systems architecture around the lithium-ion battery and the quality of the power that comes off of it, it makes it difficult to easily change to a different design like a nickel-cadmium that could potentially also end up with space constraints in the very tight electrical bays because it's a much, much larger system.
John Ostrower covers Boeing and aerospace for the Wall Street Journal. You know, one of the early critiques that we heard when this 787 problem first arose were people asking questions about redundancies and whether the safety systems in place were adequate. Has that proven to be a valid criticism? Do you know?
Well, it's still not yet clear whether or not the, you know, kind of going back to what initially caused this, because that would seem to be the key for both determining, number one, how to prevent it and how to then mitigate it in the future. As far as the redundancy of and the protection of the aircraft goes, there are many who say that, well, the system did its job as it currently designed. The battery did burn, but didn't really damage any systems or structure around it beyond about 20 inches is what the NTSB says. However, the NTSB has drawn a line in the sand on redundant protections as far as this whole system has gone. And specifically with the Japan Airlines battery in early January that caught fire shortly after landing from a flight to Tokyo and Boston, they really look at that system as not having essentially protected itself in terms of, you know, what the implications are if, say, this happens again or on, you know, either on the ground or in the air, to be able to just essentially say that any failure within the battery really stays in a very confined, tight space, and any fumes or smoke are immediately vented overboard.
So given that, what do you suppose the FAA wants to hear from Boeing as they move forward?
Well, really, what we've reported over the last several weeks is that Boeing is looking at a two-stage fix. That it's more interim solutions in terms of the containment of the battery and long-term changes to the battery. So as you look at that, the way that unfolds really kind of takes two different parts here. So you have to get number one, FAA approval on acceptance that the current battery is okay to fly in the first place, along with the initial containment. So what Boeing is going to have to do is make the case to the FAA that the containment and the later battery modifications are a comprehensive fix in its own right. But obviously, there's a strong chance that the FAA will say, okay, well, the battery and the containment need to go together as a holistic package for mitigating any risk. So whether or not that gets approved really is the central question here, and ultimately the FAA's tolerance for either one final solution, or kind of a two-step process will really be the guiding factor on when these airplanes are back in service.
Boy, given that Boeing wants to get back in service, they want to get their testing right away back in the air, the fleet back in the air, but the test flights back in the air. How fast is the FAA likely to move? Do you have some past actions that tell us what might happen?
Well, to some degree, we are in uncharted territory here. The last time a commercial aircraft in the U.S. Was grounded was 1979, and that was a very different situation with the McDonnell Douglas DC-10 after a fatal accident. Stepping back from that, looking at where we are now, what we do understand is that we're not likely to see aircraft flying in service again until about April. Today marks the 38th day since the grounding. The DC-10 was only grounded for 37 days back in the summer of 1979, and so today really puts the 787 in an interesting historical perspective in comparison. When you stack up the fact that the DC-10 was based on, you know, grounding came after a fatal accident, and in the two battery failures on the 787, there were light to virtually no injuries reported at all, save for, I believe, a firefighter with a skin irritation in Boston and a person who, I believe, either twisted their ankle coming off of the escape slides in Japan. So what we see is a different tolerance, a greater tolerance, or greater acceptance, of sort of the underlying safety and integrity of the air safety system, and any tolerance for these battery failures or fires, really in comparison to what happened in the 70s, is just so much greater.
John Ostroger of the Wall Street Journal is our guest. Given that Boeing wants to get the planes flying again by April, what prompts United's decision to wait until June 5th before they take their 787s off the ground?
Well, I think that a lot of airlines are protectively being cautious about you know, waiting on Boeing and the FAA to give the cues on when their aircraft can fly again. It's worth noting that United is hoping to fly in about mid-May a route between Denver and Tokyo. You know, cities like Boston and Denver, these kind of, you know, the non-LAs and New Yorks and Chicago's of you know, in the U.S., you know, to really kind of capture the what is really supposed to be the business model of the 787, which is flying to from secondary cities in the U.S. to routes in Asia. So United, that's a really important route for both Denver and for United to open those new connections to Asia. But obviously, as we push till May, you know, certainly. We see United being very, very cautious in terms of looking at June 5th for when the 787 would re-enter into the rest of their fleet.
You know, Boeing CEO Jim McInerney has pretty much stayed out of the spotlight during this. What has that helped the company? Has it hurt the company in terms of the PR of dealing with this Dreamliner problem?
Well, I think there's a distinct split over the reaction to that. On the one hand, there are those who say that from a corporate governance perspective, that reassuring the flying public and being out front and being the very much the face of the company through this crisis would be more beneficial. On the other hand, Mr. McInerney has opted to stay really behind the scenes and dig into the technical aspects, really the minute by minute developments of both finding and developing a fix, and ultimately being one of the you know, the key liaisons to the FAA, along with Ray Conner at Boeing Commercial Airplanes. So there's definitely a split on that. The Boeing Board of Directors that the paper has spoken to are fully behind Jim McInerney through this whole process, and they've been supportive of him even throughout all of the delays that have piled up on the 787 from 2008 through 2011. So at this point, from a corporate governance perspective, the powers that be at Boeing are satisfied with how he's handling the situation.
You know, perhaps related, but a concurrent issue with Boeing is the SPIA contract and the vote that the workers took split between the engineers and the technical workers. Does it tell you anything about what might be happening as this problem moves forward? We also have Boeing saying they've given their best and final offer. The SPIA engineers wanted to approve the contract, but technical workers say they want to strike. Everything gets kind of murky, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly is. And there was definitely a sense of disappointment from the union coming off of the vote tally on late Tuesday night. And having spoken with the president of the union, Tom McCarty, early Wednesday, indicated to me that essentially he had hoped that no matter the result, whether it was a rejection or acceptance of the contract, he wished it had been unanimous, because it does ultimately change the dynamics of ultimately the leverage of the 23,000 members of SPIA who were represented in this contract discussion. That's 15,000 professional engineers and 8,000 technical workers. And with the rejection of the contract by the technical workers, there's sort of a quiet acknowledgement that the union is going to have to be more strategic and almost surgical about the changes it wants to make in the contract when 15,000 members approved a similar structure, right at the same time.
Yeah, delicate dance. And in the meantime, the Boeing company's defense unit is preparing for cuts from sequestration. They're already sort of moving to lay people off, eliminate positions around the country. They could be seeing a real cut if sequestration goes through.
Well, yesterday, the head of Boeing Defense and Space, Dennis Muilenburg, said that that the company has planned for what's known as half a sequester, somewhere in the realm of 700 to 800 billion dollars in total cuts over 10 years, as opposed to the full sequester, which looks to be about 1 trillion over the next 10 years. Obviously, just several years ago, Boeing relied on 50% of its revenue from its defense business. The overwhelming majority of that came from U.S. government contracts. So certainly that has forced some changes at Boeing to adjust. And you know, what's clear in the coming years is that the commercial airplanes revenue will probably, you know, make up a greater share of the overall pie at Boeing. And what we'll see is a greater focus on sort of Boeing's core competencies on the defense side, sort of the tanker, sort of converting commercial airplanes into military applications, and also looking at a greater emergence into international markets. There was a Saudi F-15 deal in, last year that finally you know, was delivered, and moving into, you know, future procurement, you know, abroad in places like Japan, Israel, the UAE, markets that Boeing is really hoping to tap in lieu of U.S. defense spending, which is on the decline.
Yeah, that's hence they want that 787 flying. John Ostrower, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
I appreciate you taking the time. John Ostrower covers Boeing and aerospace for the Wall Street Journal.
And we're going to turn from Boeing to bird communication in a minute right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Pacific University, celebrating their new president with a public lecture, Cultural Shifts, Christian Engagement in a Changing World, with sociologist and author James Davison Hunter. Tuesday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. at SPU. More at spu.edu.
44 degrees in Seattle. It's windy and rainy, and it's going to stay that way all day with wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour. Today's predicted high is 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:21. Stage magic revealed in 15 minutes. But first, birds.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Katie Sewell is here.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Katie Sewell's here.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
No, stop copying me.
No, stop copying me.
Seriously. Stop it.
It's annoying, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, it turns out if it's more annoying to a song sparrow. It's not annoying. It's threatening. If a song sparrow wants to be aggressive, as a matter of fact, it repeats another bird's exact song in his territory.
Really?
Yeah. Michael Beecher, a professor of psychology and biology at the University of Washington, has been looking into it. He's been running a bird communication study looking at the song sparrow since 1986. I met him and his former student, Chala Oche, at Discovery Park on Tuesday to start a sparrow fight. It's science. It's not mean. It's science. They had a stuffed song sparrow on a dowel that they could tape in a bush, in a little speaker, and a recording of a local sparrow's song. Now, before we started the experiment, I asked Michael to explain why they study the song sparrow to learn about animal communication.
I was actually for a while going to work on bats. Bats are nocturnal. Most of the interesting bats are out of the country. You need fancy equipment to record them because that's all ultrasonic. Birds, everything is the opposite of that. They're here. They're diurnal. You can use off-the-shelf equipment because their hearing is right in the middle of our range. And they got terrific social behavior, and they communicate in ways that you can see and hear very easily.
How do you begin to determine what message a bird is sending?
Well, you begin by observing, and then you set up experiments to sort of see if you can figure out how they're communicating. If you have a good theory about what they're doing and can set up a good experiment, you can kind of figure out, oh, that's a threat signal, or that's kind of a friendly signal. And you can also, because they learn their songs, you can also figure out who they learn the songs from, because each guy's got 8 or 9 or 10 songs.
And they're all unique to that individual?
Because they learn them from one another, they have, neighbors in particular, have similar songs. We say they share those songs, and it's those shared songs that they use in kind of special ways to communicate with one another. So if you want to threaten a neighbor, then you sing back what he just sang if you have that song. If you want to sort of acknowledge him but not threaten him, you sing back one of the other songs that you share with him, but not the one that he sang. If you want him to bug out or you want to bug out, you sing a song you don't share. or you don't sing at all.
Do you have a sense of why they would mimic a song if they're trying to send a threat?
Well, no. We're not quite sure. It is annoying for someone to repeat what you just said, but that's probably not it. Chandler, do you think you have any theories about that?
Yeah, one factor that essentially, if I repeat something you said back to you, you'll know that I'm talking to you. You might not know why I repeated your sentence, but you'll know that I'm talking to you as opposed to someone else walking by. So I think that's part of it. Other than that, we're not really sure. There's nothing inherent in the song, in the acoustic structure, that makes it a higher threat than other songs.
Did you have a sense when you started doing this that if you made your fake bird here repeat the exact same song, that that would be a threat, or did you not know what that was going to do?
Well, there was a lot of debate. People had theorized that it was a threat, but you know, most of the experiments didn't really support that notion, and we decided that the reason they had failed was because it's an early threat signal. And in most of the experiments where they set up a challenge to the bird, they would go into the bird's territory, right into the middle of his territory, and turn on the song. That's the ultimate escalation. So the bird would probably blow right past that early threat signal and go right to his late threat signals, which are wing waving and what's called soft song. So what we did in our experiment was to start on the edge of the territory and then only later in the experiment escalate. So we gave him a chance to respond as if this were a threat, and he did.
And how long did it take you to figure out whose territory was where in Discovery Park?
First thing you have to do is to band the bird. So you have to catch him and put little bands on his legs, and then you let him go. Then you watch, and you see where he goes, and you see in particular where he sings. And he will sort of define his territory by the furthest points that he'll sing. So they sing to sort of post the territory. The key thing, by the way, about song is that it's a long-distance signal. And so when these guys, for example, are type-matching each other, they're usually doing it at a distance. They often won't see each other. Right now, you can miss that here because we're here in February and everything's kind of open. But it gets very, very thick. And these guys, when they sing, are usually doing it out of sight of one another. So when they get close, then all of a sudden they're past the early threat and they're into the, okay, there you are, I'm going to kill you, but I'll warn you first.
Is this what all birds are doing? Threats? Probably. Territory staking?
Yeah, so a lot of them are territorial, I think. It varies from species to species, but in the northern hemisphere, at least, in a typical temperate zone. And the funny thing is at least these guys, and in many other species too, they really know where the boundaries are and they really respect it. So if the neighbor comes over here to, say, feed, which they do sometimes, and the territory owner discovers that, he immediately chases the guy and there's no resistance from the other guy. He actually respects, you know, the right and, you know, says, all right, I screwed up, I'm going back.
So we're in Discovery Park and we're doing an experiment with how birds communicate. And can you describe what your bird, I was surprised at how realistic your fake bird looks here.
Yeah, well, he's a little beat up because he's been through some experiments. And after you've been attacked several times, your hairdo is not quite what it once was.
But is it a taxidermied bird?
Yeah, it's a stuffed bird. We got from the Burke Museum at the U. They'll stuff these birds. And we just put him in a bush. And he looks pretty realistic. And we put a little speaker right next to him playing a song. And usually that works. And usually they'll signal first and then ultimately attack.
And are you playing a song that would mimic the bird that's nearby? You already know the bird sound? Or?
Yeah, I think we have it.
Well, actually, in this experiment, we actually played the song of the bird that we're testing. So we're actually playing his own song back to him, which is, you know, the ultimate insult, I guess. And
we do that so we know that they can match it, right? If we play a random song, we don't necessarily know if it's a match or not. But if you play him his own song, you know he's going to match it. And he doesn't react like it's his own song. He reacts like it's a particularly strong insult from some stranger.
Okay, why don't we give it a try?
Give it a shot, yeah.
See what happens.
Setup will take a little time.
Well, while he's setting up, can I ask you, after studying birds your whole life, you can answer the question, why do birds sing?
Oh, they sing. For most species, they use it for two things. They use it to post their territory. Now, mammals scent mark, okay, but birds sing. They'll pop up every once in a while in various places on the territory and sing, and that defines the territory, basically. And that lets their neighbors know that they're still alive and to keep out. They also will communicate with their neighbors. This is related. They'll communicate with their neighbors. Let's say there's a dispute over the boundary, which can happen if, let's say, the female decides she wants to put her nest just over the boundary. And they sort of talk back and forth and sort of de-escalate the situation and go back to how they were. That's one. That's sort of one category. And the other category is just to attract females and to... And song sparrows is primarily to attract a female when you don't have one. So if you hear a bird singing a lot continuously, that's an unpaired male. Once he gets a female, he doesn't sing anywhere near as much.
They also sing if their female is incubating. It almost looks like they have nothing else to do, and so they sing. But they're probably trying to attract another female to get an extra pair of copulation.
I'm sad to report that they do fool around. So about 25% of the young in the nest don't belong to the dad there. And instead belong to one of his neighbors.
Geez, the insult of the nature kingdom.
I don't know. I mean, humans are better than that.
So now the bird is set up. Who are you expecting to show up for this bird? Fake bird.
Two birds. So Smack, which is the male that's holding this territory. He's been here since 2008. And then he's got a mate. I would expect both of them to show up.
And why is he named Smack?
Shamrock, Metal, Black, Candy Cane. Those are his four bands. The Metal band is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife band that uniquely identifies them. And the other are color bands, so we can tell them apart. And sometimes it makes a nice name, like Smack.
We tried to make these four-letter names out of the colors that we have. So we sometimes have names like Jimmy, J-I-M-Y, and so on.
All right, are we all set up and ready to go?
All you need is an iPod, a speaker, and a long cable to do this experiment. And I guess stuffed bird, too.
Here he comes, maybe. That's them chirping.
Both here.
That's a threat signal. They'll wave one wing, vibrate it up and down very fast. He's coming closer. Soft song. He may be matching the type. See, he doesn't have to match because this is the intruder is right here. He could just go right to his other threat signals, but he's not doing much. He did a little wing waving. He's puffed up, which they do. It looks like he's not really in the mood to fight today, or it's conceivable because we've used him as a guinea pig a number of times.
He's like, wait, it's the unmoving bird again.
Not this guy again.
The female's doing lots of...
Yeah, she's doing a wing wave. She's saying, come on, guy, get rid of him. Oh, see that? He sort of flew up towards him and then turned away. He's thinking maybe that'll work, but it doesn't work for this dead bird.
Do you think you're altering his personality by making him attack these dead birds?
No. I don't. I think we often make their day, you know. They win a fight, and they chase an intruder away, and they feel good about themselves. I'm speaking loosely, of course. Sometimes they take 15, 20 minutes. Again, they don't really want to fight if they don't have to.
Doing a little cleaning in them.
Yeah. Sometimes they call this displacement activity. So the guy is all hyped up and wants to attack but doesn't want to attack. And in conflict, he does something else. And preening is often one of those something else. A lot of animals will do that. Like baboons are about to fight and they're in this really caught in this conflict. Instead of fighting, they start grooming themselves, or they yawn is a very common one. You say, why are they yawning? You know, they're not sleepy. They're displacement activity.
Smack, you can't let us down here.
Oop. Oh, no, he's close.
Same branch.
There he goes.
Oh.
No.
So he landed on top of the other bird.
Yeah.
Victory.
That's his victory song. Yeah, he'll do it again.
So tell me what this teaches us about human communication.
Bird song is used as an animal model for studying learning, and language learning in particular, but all kinds of learning. We know a lot about the neurobiology. songbirds are one of the few animals that, in fact, learns their vocalizations. It's hardwired in most animals. Humans are an exception. Whales and dolphins are an exception. So very few animals actually learn their songs, yet we know all a great deal about the neurobiology of the system. It's a great model system for just looking at plasticity in the brain. Now, you know, knowing all that, you really also need to understand then how the animal uses it in the real world. Otherwise, it'd be like looking at the language centers of the brain in humans without having any idea of how they use language. It wouldn't make any sense. And song learning in particular is a very social process. Songbirds learn their songs much more readily from other birds than they do from, say, recorded song. Some birds won't learn song from recorded song. They have to interact with another bird in some way. So the social context for song learning is really, really important. If you got this wonderful model system for learning about the brain and learning in the brain, you really need to know something about how the animal uses it in the real world. And so that's part of the context for studying birdsong. The other part is that it's just a real interesting animal communication system, and what the animals do, I think, is just really interesting in its own right. So you just learn general principles about animal communication. I think our system with the song sparrows is one of the best studied. So in its own right, I think, is important also.
Well, thanks so much for meeting me.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming. It was fun.
Song Sparrow Fights. Katie Sewell at Discovery Park with Michael Beecher, a professor of psychology and biology at the University of Washington, who has been studying song sparrow communication in Discovery Park since 1986. And Chayla Oche, who is currently a postdoc at Cornell University. He completed his PhD with Michael Beecher in 2011. You can see a picture of the song sparrow smack attacking the stuffed bird. It's at our Facebook page, weekday on KUOW.
From Birdsong to Warhorse in a minute.
In Boston, the sea and rivers converge. With a changing climate and rising sea level, that water could be its undoing.
You're producing more water in the rivers, but the water, when it gets down to the sea, doesn't have any place to go because sea level is elevated.
Retreat from the water or build to deal with it, Boston considers its options. Later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the merchants at SeaTac Airport, including Dungeness Bay Seafood House in the South Satellite, featuring sandwiches, burgers, and a selection of Northwest microbrews. Information on SeaTac Merchants Mileage Plan participation at SeaTacShops.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:37. 44 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 48. It's windy and rainy, and the wind could reach gusts of up to 40 miles an hour. Speaking of wind, Nick Bond, the Washington State climatologist, is going to join us to talk about the science behind winter wind here in the Pacific Northwest. That's 15 minutes away.
All right. As Bernard said, from birds to horses. The Broadway show War Horse is at the Paramount Theater just through this weekend. It focuses on a boy's mission to find his horse after it's sold to the cavalry in World War I. You may have seen the movie. You may have read the book. The magic of the theater, though, with War Horse on stage at the Paramount. Three actors bring the life-sized horse puppet to life on stage. And they do, indeed. Brian Robert Burns, I'm sorry, I'm going to do that each time now.
I don't mind.
is an actor. He's been acting in New York, San Francisco. Wow, Yale, you've been all around. Good to talk to you.
You suit you as well.
Gregory Manley has been, what, by the way, is this a real place? Commissioner of the Circle Rules Federation. Oh, yes, of course it is. I read about this. The governing body of the team sports Circle Rules Football.
That's right.
How do you go from that to acting as well?
Well, there's a lot of similarities between sports and theater.
So, as evidenced by what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
And Danny Yorgas is an actor. He's been in The Sound of Music. He's been in the Shakespeare Theater Company. He's been around from North Carolina to other places. You all have the wandering lives.
Yeah, we're vagabond. Fortunately enough, yeah.
Vagabond actors. All right. First of all, watching this horse on stage, I forget y'all are there. And, of course, that's part of the point and the magic of it. Did you have training as a working a puppet, Gregory? Did you have training?
But I think I'm the exception to the majority of the puppeteers in Warhorse. A lot of us come from dance backgrounds and theater backgrounds that use props or that use a lot of partnering. We're not able to speak inside the horse, so we need to rely on nonverbal communication a lot. And those skills come up just as often in dance and movement theater as they do in any puppetry.
Yeah. Did you have puppetry at all or dance? Were you dance?
No. I was a puppeteer and dance enthusiast. I never had any training as far as I was concerned. And you know, like Greg said, it's such a particular skill. Taking it on, it's kind of like entering into a whole new world. I mean, it really takes a lot of concentration, a lot of focus. It's a brand new thing, and it takes people. It takes all kinds. You know, it's a really eclectic group, very talented group of people that we work with.
That's Brian and Danny. You know, one of the things I know is that you are one of how many groups at this show are working on the puppets.
We have four horse teams.
Four horse teams
take control of two major horses, and there's also 18 other puppets in the show.
But yeah, and done by, I mean, do you use the, you run those puppets too, or are you only doing the horses?
We do. Well, we
because you rotate through, right?
We do. We run the horses four nights a week, and then the other nights were other horses, these smaller one-person horses. We are human puppets, birds, crows and swallows and things. It's a wide array. It's a menagerie.
And somebody gets to be the goose, who has
Yeah, fun. I get to be the goose.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
That's the comedy.
I know it. I love it.
So one of the reasons that occurs is because the main horse, that's a lot of work, yes?
Exactly. That's why they rotate us between shows, because if not only is it just a lot of work, but the puppet demands certain things of our bodies. And if we were kept in those positions 8 shows a week, you know, it would be very easy to develop physical problems.
The union would not like that. give me an example. What's it demanding of your body that's particularly strenuous?
Well, I
Brian.
Pick one.
Yeah, pick one.
There's a repetitive motion. My position inside of the horse is the heart, which is the front legs. And so I'm responsible for creating the illusion of breath in the horse. The chassis of the horse moves up and down. And also the front legs, the way that they work is it's kind of this series of pulleys and levers where your arms are at a right angle and your wrists are also moving up and down at 90 degree angles. So that kind of repetitive motion with so many like tendons and like, you know, in the joint through your wrist, all that repetitive motion over and over again, it's not really, your body's not built to do that many times over and over again, to deal with that kind of leverage and weight with that kind of frequency. And so, you know, it takes a toll on you a little
bit. Yeah, you could see that. So each of you have the same position in the horse each time? Like, what's your position, Danny?
I'm always the head position in the horse. Yeah, we as a team always stay together, and we always stay in the positions to which we're assigned. We do have a horse swing who does all of the different positions with the exception of the hinds, but in all of the horses. So he has a lot of choreography in his head.
So you're the person outside with the wand moving the head and moving around.
Exactly. Yeah,
there's stage.
Two people inside the horse. One is in the front, one's in the back. The guy in the back controls the back legs and the tail. The guy in the middle controls the front legs. And I stand outside the horse, almost kind of like some people think that the head puppeteer is like a caretaker for the horse. That's not the intention. But I hold onto his face and control his ears using some levers on a pole that sticks out of his neck.
So you do the tail?
I do, yeah.
One of the things that's remarkable is that the horse is a character in this play, and it is alive to the viewer. Have you've watched it from the wings or from the front? Where have you seen it at all?
We've all had a chance to sit out in the audience at one point or another, so we've been able to watch the effect of the horses on the audience from the depth. We also get to see it in the wings, and we also get to see during rehearsals the other teams do the same character that we do night after night. So there's a lot of different interpretations, and there's a lot of room for improvisation in there.
What when you're watching it, what impressions do you come away with? What do you think when you see this puppet that you know intimately seem alive? What's your reaction?
Well, something that a lot of we hear a lot in the audience is that the puppeteers disappear, and for us, we're focusing a lot on the puppetry, so it takes a little longer for the puppeteers to disappear. But there are several emotional indicators on the horse that we each have control over: the ears, the tail, the breath. And once those all start clicking together, you know, there are moments there where it really, the puppeteers really just disappear, and you see a horse on stage, and that is what we're always chasing after.
That's Gregory Manley, along with Brian Robert Burns and Danny Orges, who are here talking about working Joey and the other horses on stage at War Horse, which is at the Paramount through this weekend. Does the horse have a personality to you, Brian? Is there a Joey that you can identify?
Absolutely.
Who is he?
Absolutely. Joey's a fireman. He's got this incredible energy. He's interested in the world. His eyes are very open. He's taking everything in all the time. He's not a very high status horse, you know. He's very humble, but he's eager. He's eager to take on the world, and I think that you know, he's inquisitive. I think he's constantly searching. He's looking to connect. He's just got a huge emotional life, and he's looking to build relationships with these people. And he finds himself, I believe, in situations that, of course, he's not ready for. But I think he also has to work through to understand. And I think that's one of the reasons why audiences have been able to connect with this play so much, is because this horse's journey, it's so easy to connect to the life of this horse. You know, it's so similar to, you know, the journeys that we all go on. You know, from our youth, we have this beautiful romantic idea of what it is to have friends, to be a part of a family, to have a home. And then as we grow up, we learn that it's not what you thought it was going to be, or it's going to be something other than what you've believed or what you've been told. And Joey's personality dictates how he deals with those situations and how he comes through in the end.
How is he different? How is he different, Danny, from it's Topthorn, right? The other main horse character in the play.
Yeah, the other horse, Topthorn, he's a thoroughbred who, contrary to what Brian was saying, is a very snobby horse. His personality is very aggressive, but at the same time, he has this relationship later in the play with Friedrich, the German officer, who notices in him not just his sort of regal nature, but also something that of a kinship to his own personality as a human being. And it's like the Sears commercial. I mean, you see the softer side of Topthorn.
Well, it wasn't. It does happen. That's a nice touch, yeah, though, in the play itself, isn't it? And in the book.
It is. And, you know, the two horses, I mean, yeah, insofar as that horses can become friends with people or each other, the two horses, which at one point in the play actually fight each other, create this really kind of sweet bond. And they help each other through this war, which is pretty scary for both of them.
You know, you mentioned the nonverbal communication that you all have to use when you're manipulating this character. So there's a few moments, but there's one that sticks out for me when I saw it, was this, the moment when the horse, he's doing many things, and then he breathes, he does this heaving sigh. Do you know which one I might be talking about? I can't remember quite when it comes into play, but it's towards the middle, really. But can you give me an example of how you all are communicating at a moment that's critical to you?
Let's sure. Put, well, I can give you
from the back to the front of the horse.
Sure. In fact, so there are several moments in the show where there's a fair amount of kind of left open to interpretation. And that's one of the things that gives life to the show, is that if an actor comes at us more quickly than they did the previous night, we're allowed to shift around or change our angle based on that. And Brian and I'm in the hind and Brian's in the heart, are connected through this metal chassis. So any little shift of weight that I give from the back, he's going to be able to feel. So I can offer suggestions to turn one way, or I can turn the back one way and he'll adjust. Similarly, I need to hear all of the hoof falls because I can't see them necessarily in front of me or even behind me. So the rhythm of the breath and the rhythm of the footfalls of the horse are very kind of key indicators on how the horse is going to move and at what speed it's going to move.
Hmm. Wait, you want to add something to that, Brian?
Well, I think he said it very well. You know, I think that having done this for, 11 months now, I think it is now, I think that we're very tuned into each other's physical cues. I think that no one of us is particularly responsible. I mean, you know, the great thing is that, you know, anybody can make an offer and that we can take that and build on it, you know, with the sounds, with the movement, everything, you know, and like particularly my emotional indicator is the breath, but we all breathe with the horse, you know, Danny being on, you know, if it's a snort, if it's a kick, if it's whatever it is, like we can all take what one of us offers and build around it. It's a really beautiful thing.
You want to add to wrap this up, Danny?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing we're probably leaving out a little bit is the noises. The three of us do make the sounds of the horse, which we always have to be listening for. And if one person begins a sound, you know, the other two of us will help him end the sound.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mm.
Coordinated. Well, it's an amazing performance. I loved watching it. Gregory Manley, Brian Robert Burns, and Danny Yorgas are three of the people who bring Warhorse Joey to life on the show Warhorse, which runs at the Paramount in Seattle through this weekend. Last show is on February 24th. Pretty interesting crowd, too, because of the novel. It was a movie, mm-hmm. play. You see a lot of people coming out to the theater, and that's always good. Yeah. I appreciate you all taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
This is Weekday. And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
And one and two and here we go.
That was the sounds of this week, a collection of all the sounds we played this week, two from last as well. Tap class sent in by listener Keith, fencing sent in by listener Paul, listener Lori's husband's coat brushing up against shrub on an evening walk, a log in Lake Crescent by Christian, a new fence along the Aurora Bridge by Paul. The sounds of the week. Why don't you help us and contribute some of those interesting sounds that you are making, you are hearing as you go through your daily lives? I wish I'd had a shotgun mic. You could have heard the breath of that horse on stage at Warhorse. But if you have a sound, record 30 seconds of it, send it to us, along with the story behind it. Short story, a few sentences. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. And I like that. I like putting them all together at the end of the week. If we can, you know, overwork Amina a little more, we'll do that again as well. By the way, there's a video clip on Facebook of the folks at Warhorse doing their work. Worth checking out as well. We have a link at Weekday on KUOW. Nick Bond, I am watching the University of Washington camera on top of, that looks out over Red Square and over to the Drumheller Fountain and on some days, Mount Rainier, and it is blowing back and forth. I see it moving, so there is wind. Wind being not so, there wasn't much wind this winter, you tell me.
Yeah, that's right. We haven't had many storms like today's, or at least that's what my gut told me, and so I decided to check. And it turns out that the average wind speed at the airport has been 7.3 miles per hour, which is about 1 mile per hour less than usual. And perhaps more significant We haven't had as many hours with strong winds. I arbitrarily pick those as sustained winds above 25 miles an hour or gusts above 35 miles an hour. And we've had only 17 hours this year, which is quite a bit fewer than normal. Last two winters had 34 and 35 hours. And so while we're probably going to get a couple at least today, yeah, it's been kind of a quiet winter.
That's interesting. Is there any reason for that? Is it part of the other thing we've been talking about, which is looking at that Arctic oscillation, or is it separate from that?
I think it's separate from that. It's just one of those things. And, you know, the winter isn't over, but the shot clock is definitely winding down. And so this is just going to go down in the record books as one of the blander ones. But concerning the Arctic oscillation, if I could just finish up on that topic, I know I've talked about it for a couple of weeks here. And in particular, I'm motivated by a seminar that's going to be about that at the U this afternoon. And there's some evidence, at least, that a negative state of the Arctic oscillation, which means more cold air outbreaks to mid-latitudes and so forth, is associated with the lack of sea ice that we've had in the Arctic in fall.
Really? That's interesting.
It's very controversial. And the idea there is that when there isn't sea ice there, the ocean is heating the atmosphere more, and that kind of disrupts the wind and pressure patterns. And it's not clear how those changes are manifested over a really deep layer and how they kind of remain in effect through winter. But if there is something to that, then we could use that in making our seasonal forecast.
So this you write that Professor Jennifer Francis of Rutgers is one of the folks that's been doing some research suggesting this linkage.
Yeah.
She's going to present a seminar, but this is science in action, right? That's going to be tossed up there, and then people are going to try to figure out if it's right or not, and the science will continue on that.
Yeah, that's right. And I expect a rather lively session, and hopefully this time it won't have to be broken up by the riot police. But
when you weather people start fighting, man.
Oh, yeah, it gets ugly. About today, we are going to have plenty of wind, and like you noted, the rain is pounding down, especially in southwest Washington and along the coast. That should transition just to showers this afternoon, except for in the convergence zone north of town where it's going to linger. One of the big weather stories is just how much snow the mountains are going to get, and especially in the North Cascades, they're just going to get pounded with snow measured in feet rather than inches.
Well, that's fascinating. Does that mean not much worry of drought this summer? There's going to be a big snowpack to deal with?
Well, we're doing okay right now. We're at about normal, and the next 4 or 5 days will certainly add to it. There's another system coming in late Sunday that's kind of just a slightly weaker version of today's that will continue to snow into Monday. And then another one midweek, and then probably a little bit of a break over the weekend, but that one, you know, that's still kind of problematic. So, you know, so far so good, and I would think we don't really have any worries about water supply for next summer.
Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. By the way, back to that wind issue that you mentioned, you wrote, at least so far there have been only 17 hours meeting these criteria of wind speeds greater than 25 miles per hour, or gusts greater than 35 miles per hour this winter, well below average. Different than the last two winters. Does that mean that what is this storm going to do to those averages? Any sense of that?
Yeah, well, I think the winds now are just kind of approaching that threshold, and I think we're going to get a few hours here in the Seattle area that are probably going to meet that threshold. But I still don't think we're going to be quite as windy overall by, you know, that measure that I just kind of picked out of my hat. excuse me. And so, again, this is just going to kind of go in as a little bit less exciting winter than usual. We'd like to be able to explain why, but it's just kind of one of those things.
All right, but great science, the Arctic oscillation and that wind. Interesting stuff. Nick Bond, I appreciate you talking to us again.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us with a weather outlook for the rest of the day and the weekend every Friday at this time. By the way, he'll be here next week and the week after, but I'll be off. Marcy Simon will be here as your host to this fine program, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, our intern. More to come. Our news panel will be here in just a few moments. Stick around.
$9.59. Oscar Pistorius, the Olympic athlete accused of killing his girlfriend, has been granted bail. Our full report just a minute away. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. KUOW and the Strom JCC present the 18th Annual Seattle Jewish Film Festival, March 2nd through 10th, featuring the film series Jews in the Arts, with films about Art Spiegelman, Roman Polanski, and Broadway musicals, plus special events and family programming. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.